Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 20th of June. Coming up on the program, attention now turns to the formation of a GNU cabinet, why weak passwords are contributing to more cyber attacks, the new power of drones in crime fighting, and stand by for a fuel price bonus. Let's start with this. And now that the inauguration is over, talks begin over the composition of a cabinet. And how is this going to pan out? How tough is it going to be? What will the roadblocks be and how to overcome in terms of dispute mechanism? I'm in conversation now with Sandile Swana, who is a political writer, commentator and analyst. And Sandile, first of all, then very broadly, what do you think lies ahead and how tough is it going to be?
For Cyril, it will be hard, but it will also be easy, in the sense that from purely Cyril's perspective, he's a very inclusive guy, he's a committee guy, governed by committees. So for him to gather as many people around as possible should be possible. However, he has put himself in a corner. When I tried to read that clause 24 that Zille was referring to, it looks like indeed, Zille wants to maintain a veto power over, in terms of the DA, veto power over who can be included. While Cyril went to the union buildings and so on and declared that it's inviting more people to come in. So that could be difficult, but in terms of attitude, Cyril will welcome a lot of people.
That's all well and good, but surely too much inclusion also has the potential to lead to indecision and inertia.
The problem with Cyril is that he has used the leadership by committee to get nothing done and to hide behind these committees. We all know that. So these committees will not be unique. He has done that for the better part that we put him into power. So the problem now is that the other leaders who are there, including Zille, Steenhuisen and the other groups, have to focus on action. Cyril is about just socializing and having a lot of people around.
Let's talk specifically now about the building of the cabinet. And what strategies then do you think are going to be employed to allocate positions among coalition parties? One, to make sure that they are appeased and are on board. But two, perhaps the most important thing, and that's to ensure functional government.
As you know, Jeremy, that we've struggled to appoint based on suitability and merit. As an example, the ID, the Good Party now, got the position of Public Works, which they knew nothing about. I don't think you should have put the lid. That's the largest property portfolio on the African continent. So those mistakes are there. And you hear people like Gaetan McCain say they want to be in charge of the security, whether it's the police or some other crime-busting type thing. So that is going to be a problem because I don't think we are immediately in all portfolios going to go directly into a proper meritocracy.
And bedeviling the problem, of course, is the idea that people are calling for a slimmed-down cabinet.
No, the cabinet has got to be slimmed down and focused. I don't think that is where our liability is coming from. To your point, your previous point, that, I mean, Cyril wants everybody there, this, that, and the other. But we've looked at it over the years. We know that these portfolios need to be focused and the minister directly accountable for his or her own portfolio. But there is a lot of other work in both in parliament and in the government that does not require you to be a minister. So I don't think you should use only the cabinet to reward these partners.
Are you worried about this notion of sufficient consensus when it comes to breaking deadlock?
The notion itself is a good notion, but I think politics has already entered it, because the DA strategically, and I think for the time being, they've succeeded to use it as a veto power, because sufficient consensus should be 60% regardless of how you calculate it. But in the present circumstances, you cannot calculate 60% without the DA.
So where does that leave the breaking of a deadlock?
This is the problem. The breaking of the deadlock could amount to the breaking of the GNU.
Correct. So it's going to require some very deft handling, yeah, if there are deadlocks, and inevitably there will be.
Inevitably there will be. I think when I listened a little bit to the speech by Cyril, I think they are probably going to call Helen Ziller back to say that this thing of yours is a veto. This is not a sufficient consensus. This is a veto. So they've not designed it correctly. And you do need those specialists, those constitutional lawyers and those types of people to design these things. You can't just have people, because they say they know politics, to be the ones who write these things. I'm not saying that's what they did, but we can see already it's a problem.
On the other hand, President Ramaphosa also has to balance the demands of ANC constituencies. Some of them feel isolated and antagonistic with the need to appoint a competent national executive. He's going to have to be looking ahead, but also in the rearview mirror.
Yes, the rearview mirror is that you have your COSATU, your SACP and other comrades within the ANC itself, who have gotten used to the culture of being appointed regardless of their incompetence.
So how does he get around
that? So that is where the knives are going to come from, yeah.
So how does he get around that?
Well, part of getting around that is the fact that we've lost the majority. We are not the only one who've got a say. So even a candidate for each post has got to be also acceptable to the other parties. So your merit cannot be a merit that is just approved by comrades. It must also be approved by other representatives. So those are some of the tricks that have got to get into it.
So just a final question then. Once the cabinet is decided upon, give me a sense, Sandile, if you can, of what the immediate priorities are that it needs to address within the proverbial 100 days.
So there are just a few things. One, some of them have started to be addressed, the whole infrastructure portfolio. Some of those problems can get going straight away. Sewerage works, water works, electricity. You can get teams to start shaping up there. You can get some of the more mature, more experienced people to start sorting out our security system, our policing system, because that is a big, big factor. And then that infrastructure thing, by the way, speaks to the GDP and employment. Once you start getting a handle on your infrastructure, you are getting a handle on your employment and your GDP. So at least those two. Then you can go to schooling. Education is in a crisis. Again, you need experienced people to arrest the crisis in education. Those would be, to me, just about the top four, more or less.
I am going to leave it there. What I am hearing you say is that there is an enormous amount of work to do in the very short term. Political commentator, writer, analyst, Sandile Swana, thank you very much for talking to me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's biggest metros are investing in additional CCTV and drone surveillance capacity, all in a bid to clamp down on crime. Let me give you an example. The city of Cape Town budgeting around 23 million rand to upgrade its CCTV network over the next couple of years, a further 7 million rand for purchasing drones, and most importantly, training operators. In conversation now with Martin Iwi from the Institute for Security Studies. And Martin, first up then, what's behind this, do you think? What is motivating these major metros to embark on this path?
Well, it is the way to go now. Drone surveillance and CCTVs, that's the ultimate security these days. And it has worked. We've seen that it works during investigation, it works to prevent, it works in various contexts. But it's how you use it. It's how It's a whole system. It's not just the cameras that you see. They have to be a control system. And for me, I put more emphasis on that control system that is often behind the cameras, because that's what keep bad guys away and that's what get them arrested.
So in that respect, then, what would compromise, or should I say comprise, a good strategy for the use of drones in particular, but also what would inform that control system that you're talking about?
Well, I think a drone system is really the ultimate surveillance system. If you get good drones that can also get good pictures, I think that's the best that you can have out there. But as I said, that it is not the cameras that you see. It is those who are sitting behind the cameras. I know these days people just install cameras and then they allow them to function by themselves. There is no monitor. There is nothing. When you do that, you are basically just saying, okay, you'll deal with the crime afterward, meaning you're going to react to the crime. But when you use these systems for prevention, there is a different method that you have to use. When you use drones to prevent, it means that as the information is coming in, there is someone who is controlling, there is someone who is analyzing. And these analyses are then used to come up with information that can help to prevent. Say, for example, if a camera picks up someone, a bad guy who is approaching a building or a target, right? And you are able to pick up this guy before he or she reaches the building, then you are able to react. You are able to send an intervention force or someone to react, someone to walk up to them and say, where are you going? You are not supposed to come to this building. You are not supposed to do what you are doing here. There you are able to prevent an incident. But if you just install the cameras or use drones and see what is happening without a system behind them, then you are basically saying during investigation, we'll look at the photos or we'll look at the videos that were taken at a particular time that we believe that there was an intrusion into the system. Basically, that's what you use it for. But I will say for me, what is important is to prevent the act from happening rather than waiting until the act has happened, then we have evidence. That's a court matter, and that's anything can go wrong. In court, if you don't have a good defense, if you don't have a good lawyer, you don't have a good prosecutor, anything can go wrong. You can't get what you want to get out of that. So my advice would be that use these systems to prevent. And prevention means there must be a control system. There must be an analytical system. There must be a response system.
Would it be your concern that these metros that are investing huge amounts of money in this process are perhaps not recognizing that and are not perhaps populating the entire value chain that you have outlined to me? In other words, they've got the camera, they've got the operator, and they're not understanding what more needs to come, and that could mean a complete waste of money.
So what I think most of them are getting is the analytical side of it. When you collect information, that information needs to be analyzed, and lessons need to be drawn from that. Some of the lessons could be lessons that can help you predict the future. Like, okay, if we keep having bad guys coming to assess a target, what is that? What is the nature of those guys? Why are they doing it? What is the trend? How is this going to continue in the future? This kind of analysis are extremely helpful. And I think these are the most important that you need to do. But most of these systems do not have that. You need an analytical system that helps you to build scenarios for the future, that helps you to focus the trends, where things are going to go in the future, so that you develop appropriate strategies that are tailored to meet the demands, to meet the need of that specific security problem. But if you don't do that, you will come up with a security apparatus that is just there to look at what's going on, and these bad guys will always be ahead of you. So I think that these systems, they need to have you know, they respond, they need to have the analytical, they need to have the operators who control how this system works.
So my next question then is, what specific type of analytical training is needed in order to optimize the equipment and to justify the cost?
Well, the equipment are there. The equipment are there. These are inanimate things. They are there to do what you've asked them to do, meaning send you information, right? But you always need a human being to analyze it and give you a forecast and give you trends for the future. So for you to understand where this is going. And once you are able to develop those trends to say, in the next 5 years, this is what is going to happen because of what we are seeing now, because of certain variables that are taking place. So if this were to continue, these are the possible conclusions that we can draw in terms of where we are going to be in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years. So if you don't have that, these have to be human beings. We can't have machines doing all of this. Because when you leave machines to do all of this, especially a typical human activity such as analysis for forecasting, not just analysis. Sometimes machine can do better analysis, but you need a human to be able to put this information together and say, this is what we are going to have in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years. That I don't see a lot of organizations doing that. And for me, that's what is critical. We should not go about or have an approach to deal with security problems by just looking at what is going on now. We have to have a vision for the future.
Martin Iwi, I am going to leave it there from the Institute for Security Studies. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there is no question that cyber attacks are on the increase and weak passwords are a big part of the problem. For instance, in 2023, the technology security firm NordPass reporting that 123456 was the most common password in Nigeria and the second most common password in the entire world. Tembekile Mayayisi is a cybersecurity professional and a researcher. And writing in the Conversation Africa, she was asked how to outline the importance for employers and employees when it comes to improving password safety. She joins me on the program now. Let's start with that then. Why has password security become so critical in today's very fluid digital environment?
They have become very critical considering the fact that a lot of businesses, even individuals, are so reliant on technology. A lot of people use computers, they use iPads and many other gadgets really to store and process and communicate all types of information. So at the end of the day, passwords are that key that many people use to be able to have access to various places where different classes or types of information is stored.
And some of the common consequences then of using a weak or recycled password in an organization, I would imagine that the risk is high and these consequences could be dire.
Yes, absolutely. When you actually look at the fact that, you know, we actually have people in various organizations that are still using very weak passwords, worse, even passwords that have not been changed at all for the past couple of months or even years. And sometimes the focus shouldn't even be on, you know, the length of the password as such, but whether that password is something that is complex enough, difficult enough to guess, and so forth. So with organizations that are not making an effort to create some form of awareness to educate employees at all levels about password management and safe use, it becomes a problem in a situation where, you know, an attack happens, and it happens because, you know, passwords were easily linked or divulged to external parties or attackers. So unfortunately, a lot of strategies are only thought of when something has happened in an organization, but there's very little sometimes that goes into being proactive and putting across something that will prevent such things from happening in future.
So is there new best practice then that companies should follow for account management and password control?
I wouldn't even say it has to be new best practice, but I think for me, it's more of just going back to the basics, right? I think there's just a lot of rush with a lot of technologies that are being introduced from time to time. But if we can just, you know, go back to the basics of password management, look at what used to work and what we can actually do to beef it up and make it much stronger, it's still a starting point. The reason I'm saying this is because sometimes having to go, you know, big on implementing expensive control measures, you know, going biometric, multi-factor authentication, and all these other fancy and stronger technologies, it may not be appropriate for every type of organization. But for an organization that, you know, utilizes information systems, information technology, just, you know, to do basic tasks, and they don't really keep a lot of confidential or sensitive information in their systems, you find that they just need to have strong control measures in place, educating their employees, making sure that, you know, they don't just leave things to chance when it comes to educating and training. There are also measures that can be implemented on the systems themselves, whereby, you know, you can actually configure, you know, your operating system environment, even your application system environment, in such a way that it doesn't allow for the use of weak passwords, right? So you use, you know, password strength meters. So as a user tries to capture a password that, for instance, has been utilized, you know, in other places, or it's weak in nature, then it doesn't go through until you actually, you know, put in the right password. Yes, in the issue around standards, best practice standards are there, and yes, it is very important, especially for organizations that stand to lose a lot more, especially financially and reputationally, to make sure that, you know, they don't lag behind as far as, you know, applying best practice password control measures is concerned.
Are you able to tell me which companies might be most at risk because of a poor password policy?
Sure, that is a challenging one. But what I can say is that definitely financial institutions, they are at risk. And also some of, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, educational institutions are not at risk, because there's also a lot of information, you know, that they deal with. There are also various other entities. It can be a manufacturing entity. It can be, you know, a state-owned entity, and many others. So at the end of the day, I think what we need to focus on is the type of information that particular entity deals with. And I think that will dictate the kind of measures that you think of putting in place. As you know, should anything go wrong, you know, the impact will be huge. And sometimes it may even take longer to recover from something big as a major breach or a hack like that.
Let's assume that once you have got a password that is safe and is secure, are there advised or recommended ways in which employers or employees can store their passwords and manage them safely? Is there new technology that is emerging around that?
Yeah, there are various technologies that, you know, companies can use, especially technologies that, for one, has to ensure that, you know, when you've got your password files for the whole entity, it's actually a file that is encrypted, right? And over and above that, it's also to for individual users, there are also mechanisms in which you can have your own tools that are encrypted that will protect those passwords that you feel, you know, it's a lot of accounts that you're administering or you're dealing with, and it's just cumbersome to try and remember each and every password for a particular system. So as far as technology is concerned, I think the pool is big. There's a lot to be explored in that front, and it just takes having dedicated security experts in respective organizations to explore and try out various technologies and decide on the ones that will be most appropriate for their organizations.
A lot of good advice there in a very important subject. Themba Keeley, Maya Yise, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, unaudited mid-month fuel data from the Central Energy Fund is indicating a decrease in prices for all fuels in July, with 93-octane showing the biggest decrease. Let's unpack that a little further. Leighton Beard speaks for the Automobile Association. And Leighton, firstly then, what factors are contributing to this projected decrease in fuel prices, and how significant is the impact of each factor?
Well, we saw some very positive movement in international oil prices at the beginning of the month, and that's held steady. You know, it's kind of flat at the moment, but the early movements in the month really played a big role. And then obviously, on average, the rand is performing better than it did in the previous period, and that's contributing to these decreases that we are expecting to see come July. Obviously, the stronger the rand gets, the better that outlook is going to look, Jeremy.
Leighton, there's always a discrepancy between ULP 93 and 95 in terms of the projected decrease. I'm sure you ask this question all the time, but what is behind that?
I'm not a chemical engineer, and I'm certainly no fuel expert. But the simple explanation is that different fuels get different pricing. Now, in the same way that ULP 95 is different to 93, both of those grades are different to diesel. And we know that there are different grades of diesel. And there's different refining processes involved in both, and there's different chemical elements in both. And because of that, you will find some discrepancies in the pricing of these two fuels.
Leighton, is the AA crunching the numbers perhaps a little bit more extensively? Let me tell you why I asked that question. Despite the decrease, which is welcome, I'm going to assume that fuel prices are not going to return to lower levels that we saw at the beginning of the year. So are you looking at longer term trends that are perhaps preventing a return to those prices a couple of months ago?
Look, it's always difficult to predict, because I think when you look at the two big factors, the rand and obviously international oil, they are difficult to forecast long term themselves. But I think when you look at the trend that oil is going into at the moment, and if the trend and the trajectory of the rand is anything to go by in the last couple of weeks, then certainly I think long term the outlook could be positive. But I certainly wouldn't put my head on a block specifically because of those two factors. They could change at a moment's notice. We know that the OPEC plus countries are continuing with their production cuts deep into 25. How is that going to play out in the long term? That could impact on those oil prices. So it really, unfortunately, is a question of watching it every day over a period of time and then looking at it on a month-by-month basis. I think anything further than that is going to be really speculative and dangerous, quite honestly.
And looking beyond July, are you able to give us a sense then about where fuel prices might go in coming months, and if there are any different or extra factors that could influence these prices, or is it the same thing, you know, just keeping a very close eye on global output and the rand dollar exchange rate?
Yeah, sorry, you broke up a little there, but if I understood your question is, you know, are there other international factors that are bringing pressure on local fuel pricing, and what is the outlook beyond July? I think there's always that that issue of international pressures. We've just gone through an election. We know that America is going to go into an election in November. How is that going to play out on the value of our currency against the greenback? What is going to be the issue in terms of global north going into winter months and the demand for fuel in countries up in Europe and in America? And is that going to have an impact on oil pricing? So there are a number of different factors that come into play. Obviously, geopolitical developments all the time have an impact on our local fuel pricing, and that's a message that we've always wanted people to understand. I think beyond July, the trajectory at the moment is downward. In other words, a positive decrease. I think for the moment, we will hope to see that. And if everything stays relatively flat as it does, as it looks like at the moment, then I think we could be in for more decreases. But I certainly wouldn't want to quantify that at all, Jeremy.
And just finally, are there recommendations, Leighton, that the Automobile Association gives to government or to broader industry stakeholders about stabilizing or reducing the price of fuel further? You know, we are hostage or held hostage by so many exogenous factors.
Local production and refining capabilities is certainly something that needs to be more of a priority. You know, this issue of the taxes that are added to our fuel is always a hot button topic. And many people say, well, let's just scrap those taxes. You know, countries like Namibia and Botswana that buy their fuel from South Africa don't add those taxes, and their fuel is a lot cheaper than it is in South Africa, and they actually buy their fuel from us. So people say get rid of the taxes. Well, our concern is that if you get rid of those taxes, government will just look for another way in which to gather those taxes, because it is the fourth biggest tax government collects. We've called for a review of all the elements of the fuel price with a view to seeing if they are A, calculated correctly, and B, if there's any wiggle movement within those elements that could mitigate against higher fuel pricing. One of those elements for us is the RAF levy. We know the RAF as an institution is in dire financial straits. We believe that people don't get bang for buck by contributing that tax to the fuel. So I think from our point of view, there are certain elements that we can look at. And it's a call we've been making for a long time. Sadly, government, the previous government hasn't really heeded those calls. Maybe things change in the next couple of weeks, Jeremy.
I am going to leave it there. From the Automobile Association, Leighton Beard, thank you very much indeed. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.